First of all, copies of the minutes of the ordinary general meeting held on the 27th of November 2006 have been displayed on the Institute notice board and will be taken as read. I wasn't at that meeting. I'm told that the senior vice president did an excellent job in keeping the discussion going on that occasion. May I sign the minutes as a correct record? Yes, thank you very much. We have some guests this evening. May I extend a particular welcome to Dimitris Bartzilas of Group Risk Department of Lloyds TSB and to all personal guests of members. Now, before we get into the discussion, we have some prizes to present. I'm delighted to welcome Dermesh Patel and Tamas Baun to this meeting, and they are the winners of the McKinsey Prize for Communications, awarded to the best performing students in subject CA3, Communications, in the September 2005 and April 2006 examinations, respectively. And the award of this prize has been made possible by McKinsey and Company, who, as well as providing as funding the prizes themselves, also support other educational work undertaken by the profession. So I'd now like to ask Dermesh to step forward so that I can present him with his certificate and check. Before we go on, there are one or two housekeeping issues that we need to deal with. First of all, you may have noticed that the meeting is being filmed in order to produce a webcast, and we're hoping to make the webcast available to members only from Friday of this week. Secondly, the fire alarm for this building is a continuous ringing alarm, and should it go off during the meeting, please make your way calmly and efficiently to the assembly point, which is outside the Melton Mowbray Public House. And for those who don't know, the Melton Mowbray Public House is about 50 yards down High Holborn in an easterly direction. I guess that given the weather this evening, you could be forgiven for straying inside. Anyone wishing to claim CPD for this meeting should ensure that they sign the forms that are being circulated on clipboards during this meeting. And to avoid confusion, there will be one clipboard for each block of seats. So you don't need to pass the clipboard across the aisles. That will just create confusion. Just pass it forward or backwards or whatever. I guess they'll start at the back, so forwards is the answer. Right, and finally, can I ask you to turn off your BlackBerries and mobile phones, because the signals interfere with the sound system, and it's not sufficient just to turn the ringtone off, you have to turn the whole thing off. Right, now the main event for this evening is a discussion on the paper, A Practical Approach to the Assessment of Operational Risk in Life Insurance Companies, which has been developed by the Life Operational Risk Working Party, chaired by Nick Dexter. And the format of the discussion is slightly different from usual. We're going to have a structured discussion, so there will be three presentations followed by three separate sections of discussion, and then we'll have a closing speech at the end. So the three sections are dealing with, first of all, collecting operational risk loss data by Nick Dexter, then assessing control effectiveness by James Ryan, and then operational risk management and embedding it in the business by Cameron Mills. So can I invite Nick Dexter to introduce the first section?
Thank you, Nick. It's good to see so many faces here this evening. We did think one of the operational risk events was the weather that we'd had on Thursday and Friday, preventing a lot of you getting here, so very pleased to see so many faces. And it's fitting that we eventually managed to get a talk on this topic in this hall, because it was actually in this hall at an Institute of Actuaries tax seminar that I was helping run at the time that I was talking to Nick Parry of ZFS, who was struggling with operational risk and developing ZFS's approach at the time. And we thought, well, isn't this a good area where we ought to be, rather than struggling alone and stopping actuaries inventing the same wheel in lots of different places, if we got a number of us together to write down what the approach was we were collectively using. We were very helped a lot by Michael Tripp's working party on non-life, who had already addressed a lot of the theory, and therefore our particular paper focused on a lot of the issues that we were struggling with in practice. Now I've heard a lot of actuaries say that you can't assess operational risk, and I think that was one of the things that we struggled with originally. We wanted to help develop a framework for actuaries to start developing the techniques and the methodologies to assess operational risk. We thought that by making various assumptions and propositions about operational risk, we could start developing those models and start a virtuous circle. It's almost a control cycle for operational risk in terms of developing the data and models. We also thought that clearly there's a lot of people actually out there who have done operational risk type measuring in banks and other institutions, but we felt that actuaries had a key part to play for insurance companies, that working with other operational risk and risk management professionals, we could look to take the subject further. Now, one of the key things we'd like to get out tonight from the working party is recognising that we're at the start of a long path, and any suggestions as to where this particular topic could be taken further by profession would be very gratefully received. Now, I'll just start talking about collecting data. Obviously, one of the key issues that we face is that we don't have any data. Now, that isn't insurmountable. There are various areas in the past where we started off in a situation where we haven't actually got data in the industry. I mean, I can think of when we first had critical illness policies, for example, there weren't any UK data per se, but that didn't stop us searching other ways of getting around the problem. We have the problem that typically in operational risk, we're looking at either high frequency, low severity events or low frequency, high severity events. And of course, it's the high severity events that can often lead to insolvency. And a lot of the well-known near insolvencies in the industry have come from operational risk events. But by their very nature, the data is sparse. So we've got to find ways around that. I personally also think there's a big cultural issue for the industry in accepting this type of issue. In that we have to think about risk management in a different way than perhaps we have done in the past. We need to think about how we can embed risk management frameworks in the industry and collect the data that we need. It's not an obvious one for staff to report how they have failed or their controls have failed in a particular area. We need to get over that. And also, ours is a complex business. There's no doubt about that. And it's not always obvious when a loss has been made. What is the expected loss and what's the unexpected loss? if you're paying claims, what is down to poor underwriting 10 years ago, and what's down to poor claims management now? So there's a lot of issues there. Now, in view of the sparseness of the data, it's inevitable we will also look outside of our own organisations or even outside of our own industry to try and learn from other areas. But the problem is you don't always know how to use that data. For example, it's not always obvious whether the claims that are incurring elsewhere are net or gross of recoveries, what the actual exposure to risk is, so you can actually scale it to your own company. But that doesn't mean to say we shouldn't use that data. The ABI's database will gradually help us in the future, and in the paper we've touched on a number of other useful databases that we've uncovered, but to be very keen to hear of any other databases that people will have used. Now, if we recognise that we've, notwithstanding the fact that we haven't got any data, that's not an insurmountable problem, there are other ways of gathering data, and the way that a lot of people have addressed this is by talking to operational managers. Clearly, they're the people that actually know what's going on in the business and more likely to have the data or the information or the views on what the potential claims might be, how frequent they might be. Difficulty of asking people in our own area is, of course, inevitable bias. So it's important that in gathering the data there are some checks and balances. For example, asking other managers in similar areas of their views and trying to cross-check the views. Or indeed, over time, we'll be able to actually look at trends in people's views and try and identify what's caused the movement. The key thing here is that we've got to start somewhere, and by using that information and building trends, we will gradually realise what information we need to collect and how we need to collect it. And finally, just to think about some other impacts of operational risk capital assessment. Clearly, there are some operational risks where we actually don't need to hold capital. I mean, the FSA recognises in a lot of their literature that capital is not always the best response to operational risk. Often, or not often, but in a number of circumstances, the best way of dealing with the operational risk is to actually to control the risk rather than just putting up capital. For example, I think most people recognise that in terms of reputation risk, the best way of dealing with that is stopping things that will impact on your reputation rather than holding capital against it. Another aspect of that, which I think is absolutely crucial for us, is to not have the operational risk in a silo. And I think that a lot of companies set up financial risk and operational risk separately. I think we've still got some way to go to get the interaction of that going. But I think it is really important to understand what implicit margins are in the financial risk elements that might also be double counted or not counted at all. For example, we've given a lot of information around mis-selling in the paper and examples there. And mis-selling could give, for example, rise to anti-selection against the company. Now that will come through in your mortality analysis and therefore may be covered through that part of the ICA, or it could result in poor persistency. And again, if you're just monitoring your persistency and haven't identified those risks separately, it could be that you've already allowed in the margins or persistency basis for things. So I think it is important that we get the financial risk and operational risk teams working very closely together. And with that, I will throw it open for discussion.
Right, thank you very much, Nick. Now, so the discussion is now open to the floor. It would be helpful to have an indication of how many people think they might speak. The way we're going to work this is that if you want to speak on something that relates to one of these three areas that we're discussing, you should do it during the appropriate slot. If you want to say something else about the paper that isn't related to any of them, then you can do it more or less when you like. So, first of all, how many people have in mind that they might wish to speak in this first section? Nobody.
Really good discussion.
How many people might be interested in speaking at some stage during the evening? Come on, somebody's got to say something. Yes, right. Well, we have one brave soul who's willing to put his head above the parapet. So, can I just say that The microphones are available. There's no lectern tonight. So if you put your hand up, the microphone will be brought to you. And can you wait for the microphone to come before you start speaking? And then please state your name clearly. So can we have the first contribution, please?
Isaac Alphon. You've spoken about collecting data about events. I was wondering if you could say something about near misses and how that can be defined in a kind of operational way.
By all means. Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very good point, because near miss data, often events will happen and you might not have a physical payment. You might be able to stop events getting to a point where you need to make payments. So I think it is important to construct a system of reporting where near misses are reported. Now, there's a question of how comfortable people are, or your members of staff, of admitting to these things, because clearly the natural instinct will be to keep your head down if you can avoid it appearing in your in some financial statements. But it is part of the cultural thing. I know one bank has, in embedding its structure, has changed its incentive scheme to at least in part reward people for... Or rather not give rewards to people who don't report things. So there's a sort of a reward for reporting things, and that would include near misses as well as actual losses, but clearly that is a big issue to get across.
Okay, sorry, yes, you know.
Perhaps just a thought to get discussion going. In my experience at HBOS, where I was Chief Risk Officer, one of the things that I found to be the most important about collecting operational risk data, and it may come across as very odd to begin with, it's making them as big as possible. So whatever the numbers are, make them bigger. And you've got to see it as a circular process, because the regulator feels that operational risk is important, and as you all know, feels that a significant part of the capital base should be covering operational risk matters. But the traditional ways of collecting operational risk data only produce small numbers. So it doesn't really quite stack up in two ways. One is it may not be given to the regulator quite the respect that they like to have. But secondly, the bigger the numbers are, the more they'll be taken seriously. Or, if not, you get the challenge back to get them back to a sensible number. But if you start them small, people will, I think, just tend to ignore the problem. But any thoughts on that?
All right, who's going to be next? Yes. Louise
Pryor. I'm a bit worried, I'm always worried, but one thing I'm worrying about here is that we're having to produce, we are having to quantify operational risk, not necessarily by choice. And it's a bit as if we're saying, well, we don't know how we should do this, and we don't really have any information to base this on, but we're going to do it anyway. So how, given the quality of the data going in, and I mean in some areas it's extremely sparse, and that's probably an optimistic view of it, how can we actually stand up and put our hands on our hearts and say these numbers are reasonable?
I've heard there's similar concerns voiced before, and my view of this is that the actual capital assessment is only part of the debate, really. I think that a lot of the debate is around getting the right management framework in place in companies to actually manage operational risks, and it just so happens that as a byproduct, almost, you do a capital assessment. I think that where most of the value should come from is actually through the thought process of recognising what controls you've got, what controls aren't working, the design of controls, and implementing that. that's where the value comes, not actually in getting to the number at the end of it. I think it's actually quite worrying sometimes to see some board reports where there is a number for operational risk assessment, which I guess, Louise, is where you'll be coming from in terms of actually a whole range of values there, and you can't possibly get boards to understand the potential variation in the numbers and the magnitude of the potential spread of numbers if you're actually reporting in that way. So I think there is an educational process there for people to understand what they might be. And the second bit of that is also not necessarily the absolute value of the capital assessment, but perhaps not as important as the trend. So if you're doing it consistently, you actually can see the trend and whether it's going up or going down, rather than just having nice traffic light reports with red, amber, green on different risks and that kind of thing, which sometimes happens without actually having some sort of qualitative backup, then I think that is an issue. I would like to think that over time, as we see trends, it would actually give an indication of whether the controls are improving or not, and that is perhaps more important.
Yeah, I'd just like to reiterate that as well. I think if you look at the objectives of operational risk capital, obviously one of the objectives is to get a relatively accurate number, but one of the other objectives must be to drive improved management behaviour. And it's certainly by having a certain amount of capital for operational risk actually does focus the mind of senior management and business managers in the organisation. So I think from a risk management perspective, as long as the number is going in the right direction, then it's very valuable.
I mean, I absolutely agree on the importance of the sort of management aspect being more important than the number. But the fact remains that numbers are being produced and people are signing off on them. And that's the bit that worries me.
Okay, another contribution down here. Tim Burks.
I think James sort of alluded to what I was going to say just a moment ago. The issue of getting information far enough down the organisation, that is important to report data, and particularly report near misses, seems to me that in most organisations there's a natural break, if you like. We're talking a lot, and we've just been talking about the importance of senior management signing off on these things, but senior management aren't the people who know where the risks are, and it can be from some quite junior levels of management where things are reported to. I haven't an answer, but I think it is probably very different depending on the size and structure of the entity. If you've got a huge company, you might actually only go down one or two levels below senior management where they have an interest, and the rest are just gnomes busy working away. In a smaller organisation, you might get much further down and probably be able to collect more data. Counter is, it's a small organisation, so there isn't very much data to collect, even though you're collecting more of it. I don't know how we cross that bridge.
Well, and clearly there's a communication issue here. I think someone who was chatting before the session started said about the need to get sort of the operational risk not seen to be as a black box for actuaries, that the whole of the ICA can be seen to be a bit of a black box if we're not careful. And that doesn't mean to say that automatically there shouldn't be any actuaries in the operational risk department. I think that's a different discussion entirely. But I think there is an issue around ICAs generally, not just op risk, about getting people to understand what the impact of their actions is on the on the overall assessment. But clearly, for most operational areas, the rest of the financial risk side is probably of less importance in terms of what they're doing. So I think that there is an issue around granularity. It's not always easy to break, in the current state of development, breaking the operational risk down into its component parts, but I think there is a need to get people involved, and that might mean that you end up with mini op risk assessments in different areas of the company, which don't necessarily exactly aggregate to the total, but it actually gets people thinking in the right way.
I'll slip in a few words. I think it depends what it is you're actually trying to achieve. In my experience, the risks which affect the number at the end, the ICA, that have a significant impact on that, are the big risks, and the big risks which boards and executive committees are the ones that are dealing with. And it's when you go right down at the bottom of the organisation, the risks that people are dealing with on a day-to-day basis don't really impact the ICA at the end of the day. But at the same time, these people are running processes and are running risks in the business. And what you're using your operational risk framework for is different, I think, at that level than just purely for the ICA. What you're really looking for is to get comfort that your processes in your business are under control. Because it's these people that are running these processes day-to-day that have got the controls, and they're the ones that can tell you whether the controls are working or not. They're the ones that have got the data on a day-to-day basis that can tell you whether the controls are working. And actually, when it comes down to it, they're the ones that give you the data which allow you to sign off your returns at the end of the day, that you've got an adequate system of control in the organisation. So I think you shouldn't get too worked up on the numbers that are coming out right from the bottom of the organisation, because the numbers don't really impact the ICA at the end of the day. But I say they do tell you very much about the state of control within the organisation.
Right, hand over there. Yes.
David Wilkie, two little points. Near misses remind me of the concept of realistic disaster scenarios, I think now used in Lloyd's, but there's an idea that I and others had developed about 20 years ago in a different context, of including in general insurance losses, this would be, things that might have happened but actually hadn't, or hadn't happened to you, or hadn't happened to your company. So the near misses are things that might have gone wrong, but luckily they didn't go wrong, but you could also have imaginary near misses as well as real ones, and put them in with a suitably low frequency. Probably large events with low frequency, they are. Second thought, Paul Embrecht gave a talk on operational risk at the faculty last year, and he's from ETH Zurich. He seemed to have quite a big database of operational risk losses from banks. Now, I don't know whether really in very large numbers, I thought. I don't know whether banks are more prone to having operational risk losses than insurance companies are, or whether they've just been collecting them or having had to collect them for longer because of some Basel agreement. But I'd have thought that many of the operations of insurance companies and of banks were somewhat similar, and so though obviously some are quite different. But at a lower level, a lot of them would be much the same. And so I don't know how useful it is. You mention up here extensive use of external loss data. Can one get hold of Embrecht's data as well? I don't know how public it may be. Obviously, it's confidential at one point in detail, but the aggregate figures may be reasonably public.
I worked for a company that had a bank as a subsidiary, and so we had access to the BBA database. Some of the data was helpful, and some of it wasn't. Now, banks tend to be, I think, it's more different than I'd originally anticipated. I thought you would be able to reuse all that data. In the end, it was helpful. But not as helpful as I thought it was going to be.
I think there are several databases out there for the banking community, and you're absolutely right. It's because of Baal is saying that they have to have a certain amount of years of loss data if they want to go for the advanced measurement approach. So they have been looking at this longer than insurance companies, but the data in those databases does vary. That there's one provider that gives quite a lot of cause information, but may not give very accurate amounts. And so I think that would be very good from a risk management perspective to actually understand, could that happen here, and identifying risks in the first place. I think there are other databases where the data is anonymised, and therefore banks are more comfortable to give give more loss data to this independent third party, and then that database is good for actually supplementing your own internal database from a numbers perspective. So I think it does vary in terms of the quality and the use.
Yeah. There's another theory which says that on these databases that the small losses, the data is quite accurate and good. On the big losses, the data is quite accurate and good because it tends to go into the public domain. But it's the kind of the medium size where it. I'd say it's only a theory, it's only a hypothesis, I don't know. But there's a question of the quality of the data, because the banks are reluctant to share that data because of the types of losses that they're uncomfortable with, and even in anonymous surveys, they don't want to share them, but they want to keep it to themselves.
Okay, who would like to go next? Yes, Jeremy.
Until the end of last year, chairman of another one, which was wholly operational risk. And what I was interested in chiefly was not to worry so much about the disconnect between the risks as disclosed to the committee and the ICA. I was far more interested in the behavioural impact of the risks coming forward and how they were discussed between the managers and how serious they were about reducing risks. So I was particularly interested in their estimate of the gross impact before any controls, the net impact after existing controls, and setting or getting them to set themselves a target impact with additional controls. And that was more important to me than the connect to the ICA, although I could see down the track that connect would be useful. I was also interested very much in the risks as seen by employees on the ground dealing directly with the customers, because I think it's those that pick up what the risks that could be large risks before they become large risks. And I'm thinking of salesmen were selling endowments in the current environment, you might hear about the possibility of not repaying loans sooner than you did before. As far as disclosing breach is concerned, the failure to disclose a breach is a breach, and a more serious breach than, if you see what I mean. And it was always laid at the door of the management, not the individual, so that the junior management particularly were incentivised to make sure that their staff did disclose all the breaches that were around.
I think, Jeremy, it's a good point about we haven't sort of touched on this, KRIs, determining some key risk indicators separately from obviously from KPIs. The early warning signals are very important. It's part of an effective risk management framework, is understanding what potentially are the right risks and the piece of information that might lead you to unravelling something that could otherwise be headed off. So developing the right KRIs and getting that reported is, I think, going to be key going forward.
Okay, who would like to go next? No. Okay. Can I ask a question actually on this section? Nick, in one of your slides you said that new business risks were not risks that required capital. I'm just curious, because things like mispricing risk, I mean, if you're a company that sells bulk annuity business, for example.
I mean, I think that in a very short period it would be, but the idea is that if you can do something about it, then if you're already committed to actually pipeline a new business, clearly that's something you can't do anything about, and there's a risk inherent in that. But the general feeling is that your new business going forward, you can do things to amend the pricing and change behaviours to stop those risks. So it's not something you would actually hold capital for.
Yes, I suppose it depends. I mean, there are some risks, like if you are pricing very large sort of bulk business, where it's probably impossible to completely eliminate the risk that you get the pricing wrong, either because you've misjudged the experience, yes, or because you've got some problem in your calculations.
Well, I think that's right. I see that as part of a pipeline. So if you've actually got a timing delay, so if there's something that you're committed to writing up a bunch of new business and you know that actually by the time you get to hear about it going wrong and the time you correct things, you've got that time lag, then you probably would hold some capital against that, because that's, you can't do anything about it. You're committed and you wouldn't know whether your pricing is wrong. And similarly, if you're committed to a known strategy of writing new business at a loss, for example, clearly under normal rules you would expect to hold capital against that kind of thing. But it's the fact of holding capital against problems with new business going forward that you don't know about is right. What we're trying to get at.
Okay, but I mean, even those problems could affect the solvency of the company if you didn't actually,
yes,
have proper systems in place to manage.
Yes. But you need to sort of identify somewhere where that cuts off, because you can always take action. So you wouldn't, for example, assume that you're going to get phenomenal, you know, that you're going to write phenomenal amounts of new business, and you need to hold capital against it just in case you did. You would have to, you want to assume that effectively management actions are clicking in.
Right. Okay. Now I understand.
I think the other bit you've got to. Be careful of, the thing you get to the ICA is that you're not double counting,
mm-hmm,
and you're not covering, are you covering that risk within your insurance risk? And to some extent I argue it doesn't really matter which pot you're covering it, and as long as you're covering it, I make sure you're only covering it once, and make sure you're not double counting, because that can become expensive.
Mm-hmm. Very true. Now it's your last chance to contribute on this particular section of the discussion. Any more? No? Okay. Well, in that case, we will move on. And can I invite James Ryan to introduce the discussion on assessing control effectiveness?
Thank you. Good evening, everybody. I'd like to talk about control effectiveness and how that's built into operational risk capital models, or how it could be built into to models. Before I get onto this specific slide, just a bit of background. Here in the paper, we specifically talk about building control effectiveness into scenario-based approaches. So we're focusing on scenario information. And I think it's very key that if you are using scenarios, that they need to be very robust, and it's worth spending the time and effort to actually get the quality of the scenario right. Also, we're talking about scenarios from a bottom-up perspective. So, for example, for each risk type at each business unit, you would be developing a scenario that would allow you to then parameterise a distribution for that risk at that business unit. we've highlighted this area because we believe it can be very powerful in driving behaviours. And so obviously it meets one of the objectives of an operational risk capital framework from that perspective. So page 6 of the report does have a good way of dissecting a scenario. It looks at the controls, it looks at the event, and it also looks at the consequences there. And assuming that you've actually dissected a scenario in that manner, then you can start to look at the impacts of the worst case of that scenario. So if we're looking at the costings, the idea here is, as one of the previous questionnaires mentioned, is that we're actually looking at the gross risk, we're then looking at the net risk, and then we're looking at how we move between the two, given the state of control effectiveness. So the process for doing that, actually, because gross risk can be quite nebulous, and it can be quite difficult to think about, but actually in practice what people tend to find more straightforward is actually to identify the key controls first. So when you're looking at your net loss, you can actually identify which key controls are relevant for that net loss, and then you can say that the controls fail, and then you can look backwards and start impacting on the deriving the impact of the gross loss. So here we've got that information in this table in this slide. And basically the way we move between the gross and net loss is very straightforward. We're just taking a weighted average control effectiveness of the key controls and moving in a linear fashion between the gross and net. Now, one thing we can probably say with some certainty is that the relationship isn't linear, but we've felt as though that would be a good place to start, and it's a good place for management to understand how this framework can be implemented. So the key controls are clearly identified. Their effectiveness is assessed using objective measures. Some organisations can use self-assessment around controls. So there may already be control self-assessment frameworks in place. So if that data can be used, that's very useful. But it should be backed up by appropriate objective measures wherever possible, because then that can reduce the impact of gaming the scenarios. So in figure 8.5 at the back of the paper, there is an MI dashboard that shows some of the key controls and the key control effectiveness measures that could be implemented. So basically the idea is that once you've got the gross loss, once you've got the net loss, and once you've got the weighted average control effectiveness, you can then calculate what the potential actual loss would be. And this is basically trying to understand the impact of this scenario given today's control environment. So then it's important to understand how we can parameterise the model using this information. One first step that is worth looking at is actually using this to saying that this is the worst case of a particular risk, and then using that to actually parameterise the severity distribution that you're using in your Monte Carlo simulation. So that's the approach around control effectiveness. Again, what this approach gives rise to is actually some key risk indicators. So these indicators can be used on two fronts. One is to look at the gross and net costings. So if you're actually spending a fair amount of time going into the gross and net costings and looking at the different expense items that could occur for a particular risk, then what you will also be able to do is actually understand the key drivers of that costing. And the second one is through the control effectiveness measures. Usually they are easier to collect and can be collected more frequently, and therefore that will give you an indicative direction of your capital as you progress through your year. So gross and net costing indicators. As I mentioned before, the key drivers of costing can be identified. So, for example, if you're looking at a business interruption risk, actually if you do a fair amount of detail around what drives the cost, then it's headcount. That may seem relatively straightforward at first thought, but actually if you break down the individual costs, then you can see that it's a key driver of every cost. Once you have these drivers, you can then set limits around those. And then obviously when those limits are breached, you can lead to investigating the rerunning the model to understand the impact on the capital. But actually going back to a risk management perspective, it's probably more important to understand why those limits have been breached and see if the controls are still appropriate. And coming on to the control effectiveness indicators, here control effectiveness measures again should be objective where it's possible. So for example, percentage of business continuity plans kept up to date is one indicator that's given as an example in the paper. So the idea there is the policy is that the operational risk policy is that these business continuity plans should be updated once every 6 months. And so you're putting an objective measure in there to make sure that they are, that is achieved. Again, limits can be set around these measures, and that would lead to mitigating actions as well as indicating that there should be a change in the capital. And the final point down there on this slide, these limits defined can be considered a realisation of an organisation's risk appetite at a granular level. And it's basically, if an organisation wanted to set limits at this detailed level, then this would give it the key drivers to do that. In order for this framework to work and gain traction in the business, it's important that the business managers sign off on the control information. I mean, this one enables them to understand exactly how they can drive changes in the capital model. The other aspect is obviously to gain buy-in from senior managers within the business. It's important to make sure that key control information is aligned to operational risk policies and that it's not out of step. Otherwise, you'll have the model driving behaviours that aren't the right behaviours and that shouldn't be focused on. And then finally, a key aspect is that the business managers are incentivised to optimise their capital allocation. If that is the case, then there will be a significant focus on the capital model and how that can be influenced. If that's not the case, I don't think we're saying that business managers don't care, but certainly I think incentivisation is a very powerful way of focusing attention. So the pros of this approach: business managers can clearly see what actions will influence their operational risk capital. Quite often, actuaries and quantitative people are accused of building black boxes in ivory towers. And I think this is one of the ways that we can actually get out into the business and make sure that the business managers understand what we're doing. I think that's very vital. I mean, in my experience, business managers do actually want to understand what we're doing. It's just that they don't have the time, and quite often we don't have the time to actually explain that. So transparency in this framework is very key. This transparency can align management behaviour with the implementation of op-risk policies, so we actually have policies that are living rather than sitting on a shelf. The indicators can be updated more readily, so that leads to more frequent model runs, so you don't have to do the detailed costing of a particular scenario each time. You may want to revisit that once a year, maybe even once every 2 years, and rely on the indicators to give you an indication of the movement of the capital. And finally, one of the good things about this approach is it is aligned with other initiatives throughout the organisation. Sarbanes-Oxley, for example, you have entity-level controls, you also have process-level controls. And actually all they're doing in Sarbanes-Oxley is process mapping, identifying what the key controls are and making sure they're implemented. So you can build on that framework, and actually what you're doing is then making sure that the capital framework is driving the BAU use of Sarbanes-Oxley. So those are some of the pros. And I think most of those pros are from a risk management perspective. Some of the cons are from a more purely quantitative perspective. As I mentioned earlier, in this framework we've assumed that moving from gross to net is linear. Obviously, that's probably not the case. But that's an area that can be investigated further. Are there certain steps? Is it a concave link or a convex link, for example? Control effectiveness measures may not capture the whole effectiveness of the control. If you want to aim for objective measures to reduce the subjectivity, then you may not be able to derive appropriate measures that will give the full effectiveness of that control. So again, you're focusing on the key measures there. And then finally, in this example in the paper, we focus just on the severity distribution, and that's where the experience was on the working party. One thing we haven't talked about is necessarily parameterising the frequency distribution, as obviously controls at different stages in a process will limit either the frequency or the severity. So that's another further area to be investigated.
Okay, thank you very much, James. And now it's over to you again. I think at this stage we can discuss anything other than the subject that Cameron will talk about in a minute, which is embedding risk management in the business. Yes, Tim.
Thanks, James. Tim Burse again. One of the issues I've had in developing a plausible adverse scenario approach to operational risk is in determining when somebody comes up or one of the management comes up with another scenario, whether it's actually the same, just a slight variation on an existing one, or whether it really is a new scenario. Now, there are some which are obviously so far apart that they're really new scenarios. And what I think I've got out of what you were just saying is that one way of determining this is if the controls on the scenario are the same, then it's justifiable to say it's the same scenario or the same event, and you don't have to treat it as a different risk. If the controls are different, then it's probably a different risk. Would you agree or not?
Yes, I think I would agree on the whole that there may be some risks that cover certain different... there may be some controls that cover certain different risks. But yeah, definitely on the whole, I think looking at the controls is a very good way to look at a scenario.
Who's next? Yes.
Isaac Alphon. In terms of developing KRIs, you alluded at the very end to the choice or the options, if you want, in terms of developing KRIs for frequency or severity. Do you have some general thoughts on the preferences between KRIs for one or the other? And obviously the context is that one can develop KRIs until the end of the days, but somehow we need to build in some way of prioritizing. And I would be interested in any comments you have about that kind of choices.
Mm-hmm. So that's understanding, choosing whether we should focus on KRIs for severity or for frequency. I think if we're looking at what drives the tail of the distribution, then obviously it could be high frequency of events as well as high severity events, but actually from my experience it's usually high severity of events. And if you speak to any managers, business managers, one of the things that they're very concerned about is the surprises, and it's the big severity of events. Quite often if there is a large frequency of events going on, then it's well understood, at least it's well known. And so therefore I would probably say that the focus, certainly in my experience today, has been on severity KRIs.
Any more on this subject? Or any other? Mike.
Thanks, Mike Kipling. I'm just going to comment very briefly on the difference between gross controls risks and net of controls risk. And I think in practice when we talk about gross of controls risk, we probably don't mean completely gross of control. We mean sort of net of sort of the obvious sensible controls. I always regard sort of, for example, crossing the road, you're completely free of controls. You just sort of step out into traffic, clearly looking left and then right. This is quite an effective, obvious control. And if you look at a sort of a company's treasury function and leaving the money lying around on sort of £20 notes on the desk at night, you don't start from there. You start from sort of net of the obvious things and look at the look at the additional controls you can put.
Yes, and one of the techniques I've found useful to do that is by looking at the key controls, and then to assess your gross, you look at, okay, what would happen if these key controls fail? So there are inherent controls in the business. There's the regulator, there's customer complaints. There's lots of inherent processes within the business that might not be specific to this risk that would kick in and actually make the organisation realise that something bad is happening here, even if the specific controls failed. Yeah.
I think the only thing I'd add to that is just being careful about the willful lack of control. There's almost a fraud type thing where, you know, if someone wanted to commit a fraud, they might avoid normal control deliberately. Perhaps in your example, if they were wanting to commit suicide, they might just walk out into the traffic. And so I think you've always got to be aware that there might be a scenario where those normal controls could not work.
Yeah, I like Michael, I spent more time than I care to think and care to remember arguing about gross risk. It's a very difficult concept for people to kind of get their heads around. What's the real risk if there were no controls? And I think it's a word of caution. You've got to just work out how worthy really is that debate. And I think my suggestion of you know, just taking out the assuming there's kind of base controls there and just kind of common sense things that people live by kind of helps, rather than just assuming we're in a treasury function, there are no controls. I mean, it's just doesn't bear thinking about. You'd have a treasury function like that. So it's a word of caution, because don't fall into the trap I've done and waste hours of valuable time causing global warming.
Next contribution? Yes, we've got one over here, a new contributor.
Hi, Adrian Fisher. You talked about the current sort of operating environment and measuring the control effectiveness in the current environment, but which is all well and good for one risk, but in practice, when you, in extreme conditions, what you might get is different things going wrong in the organisation, which will divert senior management time, and then which will cause a weakening in the control environment for the rest of the risks. So have you got any thoughts on that?
So you're basically talking about correlation of controls, I think. So
I wouldn't say I'm talking about correlations, I'm talking about a sort of non-linearity sort of thing. I'd say a correlation is, do two risks have the same cause? So it's one event, does that cause two risks? Whereas here I'm talking about, if one thing's already gone wrong, then although it might not have the same, another risk might not have the same cause, the fact that senior management have been pulled on to look at that risk and sorting it out means that the control environment for the second risk has deteriorated.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you're absolutely right. I think there are many linkages throughout the organisation, and there certainly are processes that are linked either through IT systems or through particular people. And once you've actually, if you had a framework like this, if you could identify all the key controls throughout the organisation, then I think that would allow you to start doing some thematic analysis across those controls to see which ones were very much linked. Also, you talked about the cause of risks, and certainly that's another area that, from a risk management perspective, is very key to analyse and do the causation analysis there to actually understand, are there any underlying drivers within the organisation that may give rise to several risks at the same time. That, for example, that approach could help you with your correlation methodology to see which risks are actually linked. But that kind of analysis is key. It can give good information for the capital model, but from a risk management perspective, it's also very key.
That's right. I mean, one of the examples is under BCP event. You know, what happens to your check controls, for example, your check payment controls? Are you suddenly running manual controls because your IT systems aren't working, whatever? And so then do you then have a weakness in your management controls? I think it's absolutely right. One of the things we try and pick up through kind of scenario analysis at the end of the day, if this scenario happened, what would that mean? What are the knock-on effects into other risks, which now may no longer be so well controlled?
Irina Kentix. Just almost a comment on the sort of what's next. I think coming from those comments, and also we talk a little bit about this non-linearity and also using the controls data that you already have for Sarbanes-Oxley. So one of the ways forward might be to look at the sort of modelling the processes that do exist. So maybe for some of the very big risks in the organisation, actually doing the process models, and then the non-linearity issue will come up, and the way the various controls work together will be looked at in more detail. Obviously, for some very big risk, that might be one of the ways forward.
Yeah, I very much agree with that. And what you often find with the capital model is it's one risk or one small group of risks that's driving the vast majority of the number. So it probably is worth spending that time and effort on that particular risk to do that.
Very good. Jeremy.
I'd like to follow up on Cameron's earlier comments on the debate between gross and net, and put it together with Andrew Smith's exhortation that we should make them big. Now, what you end up with when you do that together is you get and the fact that every risk must have a risk owner. The risk owner can appear awfully macho to have a large gross and a small net, because by doing so he will command lots of resources to manage his gross down to his net. And just finally, one of the worst risks is that if a risk happens and there is a loss, and the risk never was on the risk register in the first place, and that's down to the risk director, I think, that one.
Perhaps I could just add something to that. One of the questions I sometimes ask people is, do you feel that the internal audit department should focus on the big risks or the small risks? And in my view, at least, the answer is, in a well-run risk management framework, it's the small risks. Because taking exactly Jeremy's point, there are several areas where there are large inherent risks of which there are controls in place which are said to be effective, which have reduced them to apparently small net positions. And those are just the areas then in which the internal audit team should be focusing their time and efforts. But I think the important thing is to see it as a continuum in which one looks at effective risk management, which, when all said and done, is, have we got any, is it big, what are we going to do about it, and did we do something about it? And that really is the important thing to be focusing on, and not seeing that as the purview of any small team sitting within the midst of group or any particular business unit, but an approach. I try hard not to use the word process here, there's too much focus on process, but to make sure that one is focusing on the important things and that one is working collegiately with other people in the organisation.
Thank you. Any more on this section of the discussion? Yes.
Thank you. Peter Telford. A general point which I'd like to commend in the overview section of the paper, the comment which I'll paraphrase as, let's walk before we try to run. What it actually says is be wary of over-engineering the model and so on, but I think that's absolutely right. We need to do the basic things right first. Having said that, I'm going to go against it slightly and jump forward a little bit to runoff modelling of operational risk. And I'd like to suggest, thanks for the brief mention of how to use drivers in the modelling, but I'd like to suggest that in a runoff context, time itself is an important driver for a number of reasons. These sorts of risks are often latent, and the longer they take to emerge, the worse they'll get. The business that we're modelling on will probably become larger and more complex over time and introduce new risks just by virtue of that. And, of course, the organic growth of volume will also drive up the sums at risk. So that's an extra dimension, maybe for a later date.
Down here.
Thomas Baum.
James, I wondered what your thoughts were on the amount of reliance you can put on SOCs, where the processes and controls you're looking at are really focused on managing and mitigating the risk of financial misstatement, whereas ORM in a more ICA world is looking at the risk of not being able to meet your liabilities as they fall due. So I think if you get close enough to those two, they can be very different risks.
Yes, yes, they can be very different risks. I think what Sarbanes-Oxley is very good at is identifying processes, so of the people, process systems and external events. It's very good at the process aspect. And obviously some of the risks that Sarbanes-Oxley will identify won't give rise to an actual loss, and so the controls may not be relevant for an actual loss. But what it does provide is a framework within the organisation for those processes that feed into the accounts to identify key controls. And so therefore I think it's a good starting point to go and get information and to reuse it. But absolutely some of them may not be relevant.
Any more? Not for the moment. Okay, well, can we move on then? And can I ask Cameron to introduce the last part of the discussion?
Yes. Embedding it in the business.
Can I stand up for this?
You can.
I'd like to do that.
Yeah. Put this one in that thing, yes.
Try not to drop it, as I've done previously. And I will test the video camera.
the penultimate comment there about running and walking, absolutely right. I'm really going to ask how to start this bit, because this is a very simple, straightforward risk management framework, but I think it's very important to say the paper to be very sensible when we start this, to start walking before we start running, to start just to do something very simple. Because you're really trying to get through the whole organisation with this framework. So it needs to be simple to start. And once you get that embedded, once you get that basic system in place, then you can start to kind of do all the fancy stuff on top of it. This kind of starts, this is how we, this is my kind of model of how we do it, my framework. I apologise to the person who's not able to talk further on. To go for the But we start with the top down. This is the one where we get the senior management involved. We get them really start to think about their business and the risks involved in their business. The risk of their business plan, planning cycle is a great place to start doing this. And so that's where we start, and that's the senior management. Then we work with the bottom-up assessment, and this is where you're getting the bulk of the staff involved. This is where you really said earlier on, trying to get people to focus on the processes and start to look at the controls within their processes. It's very important, I think, also, talking about soft things like that, to try and embed it in together with whatever control assessment program is going on. People are busy, they've got no pressures on in day-to-day, you're running their lives without asking for them to know this. It's not just processes though, it's also just the things that are needed to run the process. So it might be the IT, it might be the people themselves, etc. And it helps to kind of go through a framework, through the paper, of the different types of operational risk. Categories of operational risk, subcategories of operational risk that people face. It helps to get create focus in people identify the risks within their area. Trying to do this, you see the little gap there. It's not the easiest thing in the world that needs to join up. It's something we want to try, but it's not easy, but it's a little bit of effort. Finally, here, risk reviews and projects. There's always some change, constant change in every organisation. It's very important. But when we do risk reviews and projects, again, to get risk assessments done, to get it built in, to get an understanding when undertaking change as to what are we trying to achieve with change. This is not the risk to the project itself, the risk to the project achieving its objective. This is what is this project, this new product, whatever it may be, how is it changing the risk profile of the organisation? So that's the kind of the pyramid. Coming inside governance policies and the overall kind of group risk framework, how does it all fit in? It should fit in. The governance policies, for example, will have in things like risk appetite statements. This way you start to kind of match up, looking in here, what sort of controls should we be having? Well, actually, going back to here, we should tell you what sort of risk the organisation is willing to bear. You've got to be quite careful with some of these risk appetites, like internal fraud is always a good one. Clearly, you don't want any fraud, but clearly internal fraud happens. And the danger is, if you said you didn't want to accept any risk of internal fraud, then you can close your business. Just by running a business, by employing people, you run the risk of internal fraud. So you're already running a risk. The danger is, how do you write that down as an appetite statement? We're willing to accept X thousand pounds worth of internal fraud as a kind of license to fraudsters, really. So you've got to start looking at kind of behavioural statements. Risk appetite for internal fraud is that we will always investigate, we'll always call the police, we'll always inquire people, whatever it may be. So the risk appetite statement can be behavioural as well as emotional. Running up here, we're kind of reporting. How often do you report? Depends on an organisation's also wants to respond. But clearly, you need to get this information here and here and pulling together the overall risk statement of the organisation. Actually, what is, how much risk is an organisation actually big? That's for me this report. KRIs, I can spend a little bit of time on. KRIs, my advice is start simple. There will be lots of information indicators already being used in an organisation which are KRIs themselves. So you grab them first of all, the easy ones, and then you start working with more complicated things. There's an institute that you can join for a large amount of money, and they share risk indicators. Starting the banking world, it's moving into insurance now. The problem is there's thousands and thousands and thousands of KRIs. So you have to be very careful. Just what's the appetite for indicators? And like all indicators, you've got to be very careful what behaviour you're wanting to drive on. Incidents. Incidents, we talked about that, your misses, you've got to gather and collect them. You've got to be very careful as to what behaviour it is you're trying to drive. We talked a bit, as we mentioned a few times, about incentivisation, but is it a carrot or a stick? Are you going to beat people and tell them the kind of control failure, or are you going to welcome them with open arms? It's kind of difficult for someone to make a mess. It's cost you a lot of money to welcome with open arms. But nonetheless, you send the wrong message, and we're picked up throughout the organisation very quickly. And you'll end up not getting the data that you need. And I think that's all we can say on the, I suppose, since the entire bit of BCP and all that. BCP often can take off one side because it's different, but it is just your plan, that's what it is. And our capital is really the output from all this. I think you start off with that as your driver, then that's kind of the wrong way about it. The right way about it is controlling your organisation. Once you get organisational control, then you can actually measure it in whatever way by using capital. But that's an output as opposed to a driver. We'll turn to my stimulating questions then. Also, it's best to do with quotes rather than quotes that office management is just a rebranding of how we manage the business. It's what we've always done. So it's just about good managers control the business, and that's all this is about, is control the business. So what's different? If the FSA was asking for what we're talking here about office capital, we wouldn't bother trying to quantify operational risk. So is that really the reason? Is it really the regulator that's driven all this? If they weren't, then we would bother doing this. Particularly this thing, for kind of bottom up. One thing I find is that in processing areas, operational risks don't change that much. And so it's all very well at the beginning to go through a wonderful roadshow, and you can get your enthused, it's great, and they're all going to love it. The way it's done, it's paper, it's filled with the petition. When you get round to the third time and more, and they just start to tick boxes, because actually they've got more important things to do, they perceive the more important things to do, and then as soon as you get to the tick box, you've kind of lost the game. It's very hard. And then this point of the cycle, the sure, there's so much sensitivity in underlying data, but the capital value changes. So why would you want, why would you? So there you are, questions to stimulate you into some comments, thoughts, see if you agree with me. Or people who made those quotes, I should say.
Thank you very much, Cameron. Right, who is feeling stimulated then by those? And just a reminder that in this section of the discussion, you can talk about anything you like so long as it's got some connection with operational risk. Louise.
The first time we discussed this sort of thing, I was really enthused. This time it feels a bit just like ticking boxes. I personally, in spite of the fact that I was involved in the Jarrow paper on quantifying operational risk, I think that it's overrated as an activity and that the management side is much more valuable. And that possibly what it does is it gives people a new way of thinking about management problems that they should have been thinking about anyway. Because if you think about most operational risks, they're things which a good manager should be dealing with in any case. You've got the high-frequency, low-impact risks, which are really possibly efficiency of process, that sort of thing. And then you've got the low-frequency, high-impact risks, which are the big things that could go wrong, which no manager worth their salt should be ignoring. So, in my view, and I mean, I say this as someone who has never actually had to manage very much at all, looking in from the outside, is that possibly the big value of thinking about operational risk as a concept is that it gives people a better handle on management issues that they should be considering anyway.
I suppose I should comment. I think I would agree. And I think one of the things it does do, and I touched on this in my introductory remarks, if you can integrate it with your control programme, I think it gives senior managers a very strong handle on how well controlled their organisation is and how well run it is. I think it's fair to say also that great managers do this naturally. And something even without thinking out, without even realising they do. I think the vast majority of managers aren't great managers. And if it's shown to them as an aid to help them manage the business, because most of them want to, most of them don't want failures and they don't want things to go wrong, then they can see the value added in using it in their business. And if you can kind of get that battle, then you get kind of willing acceptance to using it rather than seeing it as an add-on.
I tend to agree with you, Cameron. Cause I think you're the benefit of it is as well is as a tool in to aid spend on projects. So I think that we're all familiar with situations in companies when there is a cap on expenditure, there's only finite resources, and how do you determine which are the ones you should go for? Is it the fact that someone screams the loudest or knows the managing director better or whatever? So I think there is a way of prioritising projects in that way as an additional add-on to the benefits of going this route.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think I've seen it particularly at top tables and focusing senior management on where they should be putting their effort. Actually opening their eyes to sometimes to the risk that's there that they kind of know about but kind of get so wrapped up in other things they kind of forget about. And actually it can help prioritise senior management.
David.
David Gulland.
I'm trying to pick up Louise's point and also the last two bullet points there. What I've tried to do is every time we do this, do it slightly different and offer different information from people to, and then report back in slightly different fashion. For example, what is useful now is how things have changed on severity or frequency. So going back to the old on-grid thing approach, you put all your risk factors, your risk in there, where they are, and then little arrows saying where they're going. Oh dear, this thing here has got more severe because of FSA regulation, whatever, GCF is more important, or this probability has increased because of staff changes or whatever. And that actually helps inform to the board what the dynamics of the company are, rather than just a snapshot of a capital number. It gives a bit of a dynamic thing. And then you put little colours in, deep red, green, all that sort of stuff, and that's good fun too. So that's my personal way about it.
Yeah, I think the thing that's right, I think sometimes we can get sucked into whether the direction of the arrow is right or whether the colour's right, rather than actually getting on the underlying data and getting anything. But I think it's important, and we spent a bit of time putting something in about communication in the paper about different tools, because I think it is important to be able to get those aspects over. I'm seeing some really innovative ways of denoting that, so pictorially but backed up with specific data to back it up for those who want to drill down and help with the debate. So I think there is a range of tools that can be used to actually assess and communicate.
Yes, hand over there.
Oh. Stockbridge. I was very pleased, Cameron, to hear you use the word integrated in a comment just now, because I seem to recall in the early days when the FSA were driving us towards risk management, they were talking about integrated risk management. And indeed, in our own organisation, that is what we call it. Because I think looking at your first bullet point, there were a number of areas where we did used to look at, you know, a very good idea of where the risks were, what was going wrong, and in our mindset, we said we must almost always ensure we've got more than the minimum statutory capital requirement to make sure that we've covered it. But I don't think we did it in a particularly integrated and systematic manner. And I think now that's something that having this sort of need, perhaps, to quantify it more, we've managed to achieve. And I think as well, being in a smaller organisation, that is a little bit easier. You can integrate it by saying that your senior management has the risk committee reporting to them. It doesn't sit in a silo, to pick up Nick's point. And there's more integration between the management and the staff because there are purely smaller numbers. But I think at the end of the day, somehow we have to get to a fully integrated approach before we've actually embedded it in the business.
Okay, and right at the back there.
Andrew Wells. Picking up the third bullet point there and a couple of earlier comments, operational risks may not really change. But if I think about my own company, the operational risks we face now aren't really the same as the ones we faced 5 years ago. And even if they are, there might be some areas in which the controls are so very much better than they were 5 years ago that we don't need to spend as much time managing them as we did. That there might be other areas where the controls aren't quite as good as they were 5 years ago. So operational risks do change, maybe not very quickly, but they do. The key operational risks might change a bit quicker, or the net risks might change a bit more quickly. So there is scope for people not to become too bored, and I think there's also a danger in people becoming too bored. Tick, 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 oh, there's one we've missed across. And missing out the important ones. I think we do need to realise that they can change.
I would agree. I mean, they clearly do change, and we need to kind of gross and the net risk discussion again. They do change. I just think it's a challenge to keep people enthused and to keep people focusing on it in the right way and not go down that kind of tick box route. I've seen it happen.
Right. Next contribution? Yes, David.
David Wilkie again. The FSA is mentioned up there, and while all the discussion about managed operational risk is entirely sensible, one of the aspects that the FSA seem to be interested in is a 99.5% level of risk. And it strikes me that this is links to the bottom level of this. 99.5% level, or 1 in 200, really means that you could interpret this as saying, well, we need 200 years of past data, or we're looking at the worst operational risk disaster in the next 200 years. And I do some work on this in the shipping field, and I have no idea what the worst shipping disaster in the last 200 years was, nor has anybody else much, and certainly no idea what the worst in the next 200 years would be. It's obviously far worse than anything that has actually happened within the data we've got. And so we have to go to what I was referring to earlier as the realistic disaster scenarios, which themselves are necessarily subjective. I don't think the final capital value is meaningless, but I do think it's subjective. And while I do think one ought to be using all the good sort of mathematical techniques to analyse the data at lower levels, that's also important. The 99.5% level is terribly much a matter of judgment at the end of the day, because it's not like a mortality distribution where you're just looking at 99.5% point on the binomial distribution. It's more like the 99.5% point on a Pareto distribution with extremely high distant tails about which we really haven't any useful information to go there, but we still have to do it. I do think we should maybe have told the FSA that 99.5% is impossible, and something a bit lower than that would have been a realistic thing to have asked for in the first place.
Well, I do think the debate isn't, for me, it isn't actually whether you've set it at the 99.5 or the 99 or whatever. It's really how you've got there that's important. Because that, you know, we recognise that, I think most people recognise you don't know what the tail is anyway. So it's really it is a very much academic argument. So I think we're much better concentrating on how you've come to the conclusion that it is roughly 99.5, and having a robust debate around that. Because quite often you can end up with just sticking your finger in the air. I think the question is, how have you eventually landed where you are, and being consistent from year to year, or at least knowing why you've changed your view from year to year.
Yeah, I mean, I think it helps give a focus to the quantity of operational risks in the business, and it can then help to set an appetite of, is that an acceptable level or is it an unacceptable level? If it's unacceptable, then what are we going to do about it to actually get it down? And then you can start actually focusing on the risks and some of the controls you put in place. There's a kind of thing that the kind of competitive thing between firms. You know, my view 99.5% would be different from your view 99.5%, whatever. And unfortunately, I think unless we all talk with one another and all show each other all the workings, the only other way we've got of ensuring consistency is relying on the regulator. And that doesn't feel the greatest control in the world to me now. So I think that there's a competitive problem here in how much capital you're having to put to one side. And I haven't got the answers to that one, but I think it is much more, as I think Nick touched on, it's the journey to get there, and understand once you've got there, is it the right place to be? If it's not the right place to be, well then how do we change and get back to the destination we want to be in it? And is it worth the spend on the controls you have to do to get there, etc., etc.? And that's a very worthy debate to have, discussion to have.
I think it also shows the value in external data as well.
in that you're looking for a 1 in 200 year event for yourself, but if you've got 200 organisations over 1 year, then ideally you would have that amount of data. Now there's various issues with external data that Nick mentioned earlier in terms of scaling, relevance, but I think that's a valuable area to look into to help you try and parameterise the tail of your distributions.
But it's hard. I'll give you a real example. We used I used to work for a Scottish company, and one of the debates we used to have was on terrorism, terrorist risk, because the last terrorist incident in Scotland, apart from a couple of nutters with a matchbox in the 70s who tried to blow up a pipeline, I think literally with a matchbox, you have to go back 300 years for a terrorist incident in Scotland. So, kind of, does that mean that you shouldn't hold any terrorist capital, capital against a terrorist incident for a Scottish company? Doesn't kind of quite feel right, but that's kind of what the data's telling you now. So, you know, it's just an example of huge subjectivity that's involved.
Yes. The FSA is as guilty as anyone of talking in terms of 1 in 200 years. But I think you need to look at what's actually happening rather than what people are saying. As was suggested, trying to make a plausible estimate of a 1 in 200 year event is silly. And it's meaningless and it's not required. Capital is required in the system to enable the regulator to unwind the business without compromising the effectiveness of the system. From the FSA's point of view, it wants to make sure that there's sufficient capital that it can unwind insurance companies in trouble in a sensible way. So for the sake of argument, in the short term, if we put it at 99.5 and there are 200 firms, then it is a short-term estimate. And it's about a long-term average of one firm going down for 200 firms. That's what it's really all about. Unfortunately, people keep talking about it in these terms. I mean, it's even worse in banking, where it's 99.9%. Now, what happened 1,000 years ago? Well, Norman evasion? I mean, so it's not what is meant. It's really not what's going on. It's a short-term estimate, and it's an extreme. And you mustn't think about it from the point of view of your own firm, where you might wish to manage risk from a different point of view. It's the regulatory number, and that's to meet the regulatory objectives. It's an important difference.
Who's next? Yes. There's one hand at the back, and then mine.
Right. Just to cap the 99.9. Of course, it's not the regulator who actually has promised to fulfil the contract; it's the firm. So normally, the firm has its own risk appetite that sometimes can be actually very high. So I think the firm has a risk of explaining why it can do 99 point something rather large for insurance risk and therefore meet its risks as they run off. But operational risk is all terribly difficult, and sorry, if one of those crops up, we won't be able to pay out the contracts. So I think data is a big problem, but it's part of the risks. You've got to have capital for it. The other thing that strikes me, and I'm very interested in this for any other comments, is it always strikes me operational risk has a lot of emotion around it. If the regulator wants to annoy the actuary, we put an add-on to mortality. If we want to annoy the entire board, we put an add-on onto operational risk. And it comes back to the large gross small net. Any implication that there's actually a large net or just running a business is always going to have quite a considerable net can sometimes engender the wrong sort of reactions.
Yes, I quite liked Andrew's idea of going back in history to look for lessons. It was clearly one that the Cameron will have to look back to the time of that great Scottish terrorist Robert the Bruce, and we of course have to look to that great English risk manager, the Butcher Cumberland. On a more serious note, although the paper has an appendix covering mis-selling risk and indeed a section or two on it, we haven't actually spoken very much about it, and that is quite a challenging area to put a reserve for. Not the least, I think, because if you think that you actually have missold any particular group of policies, you are to a certain extent obliged to go and provide compensation to them. Therefore, almost by definition, you don't think you have missold any of your other policies. And I suppose the risk that you're then perhaps really protecting against is the fact that although you don't think that, someone else, such as the regulator or a court, might at some time in future think that you actually have. But in a sense, if you start providing capital or large amounts of specific capital and you disclose the purpose of why you're holding that capital, it does seem to suggest to the regulator might sort of wonder whether they ought not be looking a bit more closely at why you're holding such a large amount of capital against that particular risk, which poses somewhat of a moral dilemma when setting capital in that area.
I would agree, it is a moral dilemma, and I think a lot of the risk is down to an external body deciding, whether it be the regulator, the ombudsman or whatever, deciding that something which, as you say, you thought wasn't missold, and you may passionately believe is not missold, nonetheless it's been decided it has been missold, and therefore you have to undertake the costs associated with that. I think that's really what we're talking about.
Next contribution.
The financial markets tend to believe that banks are less risky than insurance companies. Now, obviously, there's lots of risks specific to insurance companies, but purely from an operational viewpoint, from the data that you've seen, are insurance companies more risky than banks?
From whose point of view? as far as the regulators are concerned, banks are riskier because a major bank going down causes real problems to the financial system. Major insurer isn't very nice, but it has slightly different effects.
Maybe in terms of how much capital they hold?
In principle, they are benchmarked so that they need roughly the same amount of capital per unit of risk taken, but of course the nature of the risks taken is very, very different. So one of the things that I think is worth saying here is the FSA has sort of got a bit of a problem because there is actually a very real opportunity for firms who feel that they've been picked upon by the FSA to take action. And the response of the FSA, perhaps deliberately or whatever, is to try to create a much more level playing field. And in that sense, is it perfect as it is today? No. But I really do think the FSA is very much to be commended for moving down an approach through which things become much, much more transparent. So when we talk about 99.5, whatever it means, I think the point was made, the most important part of that at the end of the day, from the FSA's point of view, is their ability to benchmark one firm across another and therefore set relative capital requirements in a way which reflects the quality of the control risk management frameworks between those firms.
Yeah, I've worked in an insurance company and a bank, and I wouldn't generalise between the two. I think it would depend on the type of organisation. Operational risk is something that can occur in any organisation, and it depends on the controls and the processes and the tone from the top in a particular organisation. So I probably wouldn't go between insurance companies and banks.
Okay, who's next? Maybe your last chance. No? Nobody wants the last chance. Okay, in that case, I'll ask Andrew to close the discussion.
Thank you. Let's see. Could I ask a colleague to drive the slide? Thank you very much. Risk management. I'm sure you've got your own way of representing risk management, but it's simplest terms. It's, have we got any? How big is it? What are we going to do about it? And something about it. You'll have your own way of doing it, but that's really fundamental. Now, another way of looking at that is to say risk management, or the essence of it, is to think about a subset of the important things facing a business. Now, I would hope that that's actually an exciting prospect. which it offers an interesting contradiction to the reaction of some people within firms when it comes to operational risk assessments. And in practice, if we have a look at how successful operational risk management is across the industry, well, the next slide is a personal view, but here it is. I expect you disagree with a lot of that. But when all said and done, there are very, very few firms across the financial sector who actually manage operational risks well. That may be my personal scoring, but I would challenge you to state that that sort of assessment is inconsistent with the letters that the FSA has been writing to the industry, financial service industry, about the effectiveness of operational risk. Certainly, very much so in the case of banks. Why is this? Well, for me, it's partly because, and here I seek to be controversial deliberately, in many ways, operational risk doesn't really exist. And I'd like to explain to you that why that is the case and why it's perhaps important to look at it in that way in order to then manage operational risk well. So if I could just ask my colleagues just to put another slide through. If I just ask you to focus on that second bullet point. Part of the problem, to my mind, and I've been working in operational risk since the very early 90s, is operational risk isn't really a single discipline. And that's why I say you can regard operational risk as perhaps not really existing. Actually, it's a collection of specialist risk management areas. Let me give you an example. IT. So, for example, many of those responsible for leading the operational risk framework within financial services companies would not be particularly expert in IT. And as a result of which, often it's the case that firms then don't incorporate that specialism to a big enough degree. And that really is at the core. So in order to be effective at managing operational risk, to get back to that previous slide, then one of the things that I think is very important is to treat the individual important specialist areas as individual things. I think the second thing that's very important is to, when it comes to embedding, if you're setting about developing or implementing an operational risk framework within your firms today, that's great. There are a number of approaches you can use to do that. But if it's something that you've had in place for some time and yet embedding is still a problem, then I'd encourage you to think about it in a different way. And indeed, in one of the firms I was working for, this is indeed the conclusion that we came to. And so we developed a new approach, the new operational approach, NORA. In no sense am I going to suggest that NORA is the answer to anything. But I'd just like to share a couple of features about it, just relating to those points about focusing on those specialist areas. So if you would. Now, I don't know just how visible that is to you, given the colours.
Not very, I think.
So that's always a shame with these things, in which case all I invite you to notice then is the circle, the loop would perhaps be a different way of putting it, in which the thing goes round and round. If you don't have something that goes round and round, then it is not effective risk management. And the essence to success is to make sure that you achieve that. And in order to achieve that, I think what you should look at then is executing that sort of loop as follows. If you would mind, Nick, thank you. So one of the suggestions I'd make is that where you separate off specialist areas, you tend to find firms much more comfortable about how they're managing mortality for the sake of argument. Now, after all, it's one of the important risks within life companies. There are many other important areas of risk within life companies. And what one seeks to do is to find an effective risk management framework for those things that are important. So one of the advices I would have for you is keep operational risk as small as possible. so that you can focus on the important things. But when you do adopt your definition, whatever definition you choose, split it up into those areas which are important. And one of the paraphrases I'd almost give to Nora, whatever it is very much as the who cares model. Because in order to get things done effectively, you must only do the things that are important. And you must achieve that focus on that loop going round and round. So if you don't believe in your firm that procurement's important risk, don't include it. But just make sure that you are including and having the right focus on the important things. Now, the model Nora, in no sense do I suggest you is the only way of doing it. It is a model which has achieved some acclaim in some firms, and other firms are looking at it. So it is something you might like to try. I haven't explained all of it. I've just given you a very brief introduction to it. So to come back, we've had some concern this afternoon over the quality of the numbers. We've had some concerns about sign-off. We've had some concerns about people getting tired with constant risk management assessments and so forth. Operation risk is very much a new area, even within the banking world, where the sort of disciplines emerged, as I say, from the very early 90s onwards. It took many, many years before banks wanted to talk with pride about credit risk. It took the actuarial profession many years before it wanted to talk with pride about the classic actuarial risks. So it's hardly surprising that this is an area of development. And I think the key thing is to make sure that that continues to move on. And I think the key thing of making it move on is to get that circle of things going round and round. And if you can't achieve that, then I think you just need to change your approach. So, that said, I hope that has been a useful summary of some of the things which are important about achieving effective operational risk framework. And I hope you'll see that there's nothing there which is in any sense inconsistent with all of the previous discussion and all of the remarks made from the floor. It's about how do you get it to go together so that it works time and time again. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you very much, Andrew. Do our presenters want any last words, or are you all done?
If I can just add one thing. I mean, if anybody has got any specific things that we're professional to be doing in this area, it's one of the things that we haven't addressed was how to take this forward. But we're always interested in if any of the anybody who's particularly involved in this area has got ideas of what work, further work we need to do as a profession to push this forward, then that would be very welcome.
Yeah, I was just going to say I'd echo that. The paper tried to answer a lot of questions. It probably raised just as many questions as it tried to answer. So I think there's a lot of areas to focus on going forwards.
Excellent. Okay, well, thank you very much. I think the paper that the Working Party produced is an excellent document, lots of very good material in there, and that, together with the presentations, have prompted a very interesting discussion, despite nobody having apparently come with anything prepared to say. So I'd like to thank our presenters this evening and the other members of the Working Party and our closer, and can we all show our appreciation for them? Thank you also, of course, to those who participated in the discussion. And if any of you do secretly have prepared notes, it would be very helpful if you could hand them to Pauline Simpson or Maria Lyons at the back of the hall as you leave the meeting. It will help preparing the transcript for the British Actuarial Journal. The next sessional meeting of the Institute of Actuaries will take place at 5 o'clock on Monday the 26th of February 2007, that's 5 weeks today, when a discussion on should projections of mortality improvements be subject to a minimum value
will take place. I suspect it will be a slightly wider discussion than just that, just addressing that one question. But it's a discussion on mortality improvements anyway. I'd like to invite you all to join me in continuing to tonight's discussion over a glass of wine in the council chamber, and tonight's drinks have very kindly been sponsored by KPMG. Could those who are in the council chamber help by moving the chairs, please? And I now declare the meeting closed. Thank you very much.